of rain meant that the jetty was deserted, and I drew up next to it unobserved. I brought the small craft in by her stern, kept the motor running, and tied her off tight to a bollard. I jammed the other oar through the spokes of the wheel to lock it in position, and threw the backpack and makeshift crutch onto the jetty. With the engine straining to take the boat back to sea, the mooring line was pulled tight, and I used it for support as I crawled up next to the crutch. Armed with a knife I had found on board, I slashed the mooring line and watched the boat launch itself towards the darkness of the clashing rocks. Even if it managed to make it through the channel, the surrounding coast was so rugged I knew it would be thrown ashore and smashed to pieces before dawn. I slung the backpack over my shoulder and settled myself onto my crutch. Looking like a soldier returning from some distant war, I made my way past two shuttered cafes and into the back streets of a tiny town I barely remembered. Chapter 46. The curtains were drawn in the mean houses and the streetlights were few and far between. In the gathering darkness, I made my way down a narrow street, and just when I was worrying that I had made a wrong turn, I saw a communal water fountain. The old bucket was still tied to the rope, and the flowers surrounding it were as dead as they had always been. With my body almost spent, I limped past it and reached the old cottage, the lettering on its brass plaque almost illegible now. I knocked hard on the door and, after what seemed an age, it opened, and I saw Dr. Sidney standing on the threshold. Unshaven, his baggy shorts swapped for a pair of frayed chinos and teamed with an old Oktoberfest 92 t-shirt, but otherwise little changed in the intervening years. While the booze had probably continued to play havoc with every other organ, his mind and his memory were holding up remarkably well. There was something in my face that he recognized, and I watched him dredging through the past to find a name. "Jacob, isn't it?" he said. "Near enough," I replied. I saw him take in my bandaged shoulder and foot, the ragged clothes and my haggard expression. "You're looking well, Jacob," he said, deadpan. I nodded. "You too, Doctor. Nicely turned out as always." He roared with laughter. "Come in. We can keep lying to each other while I see if we can save that foot." He led me inside, and I realized what a strange thing memory was. The rooms seemed much smaller, the distances far shorter than the night we had carried Mac along the same route. In the kitchen, the Australian got three lamps into position, laid me on the kitchen bench, stripped off the bandages, took one look at my foot, and hit me with a massive dose of IV antibiotics, and an even larger amount of painkillers. Thankfully, when it came to medicine, subtlety wasn't his strong suit. He decided that, despite the swelling and purple bruises, neither my ribs nor my kneecap were broken. Fractured, maybe, but there was no way of telling without an X-ray. "Feel like a drive to the hospital in Milas?" he asked. He saw the look on my face and smiled. "Oh, I didn't think that was an option," and told me he would splint and bandage them as best he could. After that, he injected a local anesthetic, cleaned and sutured the gunshot wound, and told me I was a lucky man. "I don't feel like it," I replied. "Half an inch difference, and it wouldn't have been a hospital for you, even a makeshift one. It would have been the morgue." With the rest of the wounds taken care of, he turned his attention to the havoc wrought by the hammer blows. He had been a pediatric surgeon, highly experienced with victims of car wrecks, so I believed him when he told me that the bruising and swelling would eventually take care of themselves. "There's little I can do about the small bones that have been broken without scans, X-rays, and an operating theater," he said, smiling. "A steady hand would help, too." He decided to manipulate the bones individually into the best position, then set and bandage it, hopefully holding everything in place. "You're going to have to do intensive exercise to keep the ankle mobile and prevent the muscles of your lower leg from atrophying. Maybe it'll work." I nodded, and he adjusted the lamps in order to start. "This is going to hurt." He got that part right. Sometime after midnight, the work was done, and he called a halt. I was slipping in and out of consciousness, and I think he doubted whether I could take much more. Holding me under the arms, he got me off the bench and we crossed the kitchen, entered the living room, and headed for a stairway leading to a disused bedroom. Halfway there, I heard voices coming from a corner of the room and saw the old TV again, tuned to CNN. It was the evening news, and the network's Washington correspondent was reporting on the frantic efforts since early in the morning to locate and seize 10,000 doses of flu vaccine that had been accidentally contaminated with potentially lethal traces of engine oil. I didn't want the doctor to know I had any interest in the event, so I told him that I needed to rest a moment. Holding on to the back of a chair, I looked at the screen.
"The alarm was first announced by the president in a 6 a.m. press conference," the correspondent reported. "Simultaneously, the FBI and local police agencies across the country started locating and securing all flu vaccines manufactured at a plant in Karlsruhe, Germany, operated by Chiron Chemicals. The president delivered high praise to the staff of the Food and Drug Administration, who uncovered the problem and alerted the White House in a 4 a.m. phone call. Ready?" the doctor asked, and I nodded, letting him help me up the stairs. I wasn't surprised by the story Washington was relating. What was it somebody once said? In war, the first casualty is truth. I reached the bed and lowered myself down. My head hit the pillow. The doctor turned out the light, and I drifted into a strange unconsciousness. Chapter 47. The fever rocketed during the confusion of days and nights that followed, and the doctor barely had a chance to leave the small room. He told me later that he had sat at my side, sipping on a bottomless glass of Jack, and listening to me roam across a remarkable dreamscape. He heard tell of a man tied to a plank drowning in an endless ocean, a father beheaded in the blistering sun, a city littered with people bleeding out from an incurable virus, a child with Down syndrome hanged by the neck. He said, smiling, that the mind was a strange thing. How, under the onslaught of a fever and high doses of medication, it could invent such terrible fantasies. If only he had known. Worried that the horrors were growing worse, and convinced that it was a bad reaction to the drugs, he decided to wind them right back. Maybe it was the adjustment to the medication, or perhaps nature just ran its course, but the fever peaked and the nightmare memories diminished. When I finally managed to take some solid food, he decided to venture into the village to pick up some groceries and other supplies. I figured he had probably run out of Jack. He returned a troubled man. He told me that a man and woman had arrived, claiming to be tourists on a road trip, and had made supposedly casual inquiries at both village cafes about whether any Americans had passed through recently. I always knew that Whisperer and his legions would find me. People talk, Echelon listens, somebody would have gone into the archives and found the account of Mac's death all those years ago. I didn't fear the strangers, though. I knew they had been sent to help me in case I needed it. And yet I had no intention of talking to them. I was a ruin of a man, but I had done my duty. Nobody could ask any more than that, and how I stumbled my way through the wreckage that remained was entirely my business. I told the doctor nothing about the interlopers, but I noticed as the day wore on that he was becoming increasingly worried about what had turned up on his doorstep. That night, for the first time, I made my way slowly down to the kitchen and discovered that he was quite a cook. As he seasoned what he called his signature dish, lamb marinated in thyme and garlic, he asked me if I still sang the midnight special. "Do I think about Mac, you mean?" I replied. "More times than I ever imagined." "Me too," he said. "A terrible night. Just after you left, I heard a chopper come in. They picked up his body, huh?"
"Yeah."
"Where was he buried?" He tried to make it sound casual, but it was a strange question, and I knew where he was heading.
"Arlington," I replied.
"He was in the military?"
"Sure.
He just happened to be a fighter in a war that had never been declared."
The doctor put his herbs down and turned. He had arrived at his point.
"You too, Jacob? Is that what you do?"
"Worried, doctor?"
"Of course I'm fucking worried. I've been worried since the night you arrived. As soon as you went to sleep, I opened your backpack. There was a SIG covered in gunshot residue and enough ammunition to arm a small African country. Now, two people turn up, and I'm wondering when the shooting is going to start. He was a good man. He had done the right thing by me, and he deserved an honest answer. Yeah, I'm a soldier too. Enlisted, a mercenary. I smiled. Drafted on this occasion. CIA? Something worse. I like to think better, but your mileage may vary. And the people in town. They're ours. They're here to check that I'm okay. You sure? They're not killers, Doc. If they were, we'd already be dead. There's nothing to worry about. I give you my word. I could see it reassured him, and I was glad I had done it. A few days later, just after dusk, there was a knock at the door. There was something about it, the loudness, the fact that the front gate hadn't creaked on its hinge the time of day, that worried me. I nodded to the doctor to answer it, and limped as fast as I could to the old bedroom, where a narrow window offered a decent view of the front door. A guy in his 30s was standing there, dressed like a tourist, but so hardwired, so full of tension, that the clothes would have fooled only the most casual observer. The doctor opened the door, and the tourist told him that he wanted to speak to the man who had arrived at the house a few weeks previously. The doctor told him that the only other occupant had been his brother, on a family visit, who had returned to Australia a couple of days earlier. The agent just nodded. I figured he had been told to play it cool.
"Well, if your brother comes back," he said, "and you happen to discover that he's an American with a bullet wound in his shoulder, give him this, will you?"
He handed over a sealed package and left. Standing in the kitchen a few minutes later, the doctor watched me break the seal and spill out a clutch of letters. His eyes widened as he saw that the first envelope was embossed with the seal of the President of the United States. He was even more surprised when I ignored it and looked at the others. I recognized the handwriting on one. It was from Whisperer, and I put it next to the President's. Two letters remained. One was in an NYPD envelope with Bradley's details on the back, and the other, written in a strange scrawl, was addressed to the Oval Office with a note to, "Please pass it on to the man who sometimes uses the name Jude Garrett." I knew who it was from. I picked those two up, limped across the kitchen, and went up to my room. Chapter 48. I read Bradley's first. He said that as soon as he had left the nanny's house, she had phoned the local cops and told them what had happened. Because she worked for Kamali, she had no difficulty convincing them that the story was true, despite its extraordinary nature. A black American wasn't exactly hard to locate, and, alerted by an all-points bulletin, a prowl car picked him up before he had even reached the hotel. They slammed him over the hood, disarmed him, and took him down to the precinct house. He was fearing the worst, some Turkish form of enhanced interrogation, but by then all hell was breaking loose at the theater of death. American choppers from the Mediterranean fleet had already been dispatched at the president's order. Not to pick me up, but to secure the Saracen and collect evidence. Grosvenor phoned the president of Turkey, alerted him to their approach, and told him that they had located the man attempting to buy the nuclear trigger. As a result, MIT operatives and the Turkish military all converged on the ruins. With two Turkish Navy destroyers standing offshore, half a dozen U.S. helicopters on the beach, and 200 military personnel and intelligence agents in the ruins, the order went out to put Bradley on ice until the situation became clear. After 5 days in a cell, and following a direct request from Grosvenor to his Turkish counterpart, Bradley was released and had his passport returned. He went back to the hotel and had a tearful telephone reunion with Marcy, who, once she had recovered, asked him when he would be home.
"A few days," he said.
"What?" she cried. A cop to the very end, he wasn't leaving without organizing the extradition of Cameron and Ingrid for the murder of Dodge and the woman at the Eastside Inn. The next morning, less than 12 hours after his release, he returned to the precinct house and went to Kamali's office. Hyrenisa told him in hushed tones that her boss was still being debriefed, and sticking steadfastly to the story that I had recommended to her, it seemed. So he asked to see whoever was in charge of the murder investigation. After a flurry of phone calls, the kid in the shiny boots escorted him to the luxurious office of the Bodrum police chief. I recalled the man. I had seen him when half of his force were pursuing me through the boat repair facility, the night that I had pancaked SpongeBob. The chief was in his 50s, big and florid with pampered skin and a neat mustache, the gold buttons of his impressive uniform threatening to burst at any moment. Despite the eau de cologne he was wearing, he had a smell about him, and I couldn't say I was surprised by what Ben reported. He wrote that the chief said he had received extensive legal submissions from lawyers acting on behalf of both Cameron and Ingrid. As I had anticipated, the moment the two women had left their interview with me, they had immediately gone and lawyered up. The chief said that the submissions led him personally to review all the evidence.
Naturally, I had to discount everything supposedly discovered by the man calling himself Brody David Wilson. He wasn't even a member of the FBI and had entered the country under false pretenses. As we know, he had his own agenda in complicating and prolonging the case. My own review showed that the work of the Turkish detectives was outstanding as usual. It was clear that their initial finding was correct. Mr. Dodge had died by misadventure. His fall was a tragic accident.
Ben stared at him in disbelief, but the big Turk didn't seem to notice. He smiled, lit another cigarette, and spread his hands wide.
Of course, I didn't want to make that judgment on my own, so I presented the evidence and the legal submissions to one of our most esteemed local judges. He too could see no reason for holding the two women and the other material witnesses in Bodrum any longer. He suggested, and I agreed, that we return the passports and release them on bond, pending any further inquiries.
Release them?
Ben asked, taking it hard, again acting as the champion of the dead.
How much was the bond?
The Turkish cop tried to blow him off.
There were 10 of them, I'm not sure. There's a file, I'd have to...
How much?
Ben insisted, not bothering to hide his anger. The chief dropped all pretense of civility.
$200,000 each,
he snarled. 10 people, $2 million. It was a fortune, but not to Cameron. Ben didn't need to ask what she had done. Of course she would have paid the bribe and bought their way out.
When did they leave?
He asked in despair.
3 days ago. They got on board the huge cruiser, and an hour later were sailing out.
What if your further inquiries turn up something?
Ben asked bitterly.
What do you do then?
We write and ask them to come back, but as I told you, I'm sure that won't be necessary.
Ben said the guy was almost smiling. As I mentioned, I wasn't surprised. With the FBI out of the picture, armed with all of the work which I had done, the Bodrum police chief and a corrupt judge had seen that they had Cameron cornered and did what generations of their Ottoman predecessors had done. They put their hand out. Ben wrote that there was little he could do. The two perps had left Bodrum, and Cameron's payment had guaranteed that all the material witnesses had scattered too. He thought perhaps he could pick the case up in New York, but he was realistic enough to know that, with limited resources, and one killer officially listed among the dead at the World Trade Center, unless the two women returned to America, he had little hope. With that much money, they certainly didn't need to go back. They could travel the world for the rest of their lives. I sat in silence for a few minutes, thinking about the two women and their crimes, but even then I didn't recall it. No, the comment Ingrid had made to me about not understanding the half of it never even entered my head. Chapter 49. The second letter, the one addressed to Jude Garrett via the Oval Office, was from Battle Boy. It was better written than I could have imagined, and knowing the big guy, I was certain that he must have sweated over it for hours.
I was in handcuffs and shackles,
he said.
What if 10 prisoners inside a bus with barred windows? We were heading across the runway at LaGuardia to take a Conair flight to the big house down in Kansas, when two black SUVs with their sirens going made a stop. I figured that whoever the guys inside were, they must have had a really high security clearance to drive across an airport, but apart from that, I wasn't interested. That morning, I had written to Rachel telling her not to wait for me, and I was trying to work out how I would deal with 15 years in Leavenworth.
He told me that the two U.S. Marshals on board the bus, guys who hadn't stopped sneering at him because of his size and eccentricity, got out and met the men in suits who were scrambling out of the SUVs. The most senior of the suits, who turned out to be a high-ranking executive in the Department of Justice, showed his ID and started barking orders. As the convicts watched through the barred windows, the two marshals immediately got back on board and made their way through the prisoners.
They stopped next to me, unlocked the chain securing me to the seat, and led me towards the door. I asked them what the hell was happening, but they didn't answer. They probably didn't know themselves. On the runway, the executive officer handed me a letter. I ripped open the envelope and saw that it was from the Oval Office, but I didn't know what it meant. For once in my life, I couldn't compute. By the time I finished reading it, I was pretty close to crying. It was a presidential pardon. "For services in defense of your country," it said. "God knows who you are, but you said you would do everything possible to help me, and you did."
He wrote that, after the formalities were completed, he made his way back to old Japan, ran through the apartment without even taking off his shoes, and found Rachel in a corner of their bedroom, distraught. She looked up, saw him, and thought for a moment it was a dream. Then the dream smiled, reached out his arms to her, and, being the son of devout Catholic parents, told her in wonder,
"It's the Gospel of St. Mark, babe. Chapter 16, verse 6.
She had no idea what he was talking about, and didn't care. She let him fold her into his huge embrace, kissed him, and, after they had stood for a long time in silent gratitude, he sat down and wrote the letter to me.
"You gave me a second chance. A chance for life, a chance for love, a chance for kids. How do you thank somebody for that?" he said. "I suspect that we'll never see each other again, but always remember, on this date every year we will set a plate at our dinner table for you and wait for your knock on the door. Travel safe, and may God, by whatever name you know him, protect you."
Chapter 50. The following day, after my normal routine of exercise and physiotherapy, I took stock of my health. While it was clear my foot was healing, I had to admit that if I ever wanted to regain the complete use of it, I had to increase dramatically the amount of work I was doing. I discussed it with the doctor, and that night, after dinner with the village in darkness, I ventured out for the first time. Slowly, forsaking my makeshift crutch for a walking stick, I made my way down the narrow streets and along the waterfront, dragging my foot in a strange limp as I became increasingly tired, but forcing it to function. It was slow and excruciating, and after 2 hours, I finally made it back through the front gate and collapsed in the living room. The doctor was already in bed, and after I recovered, I took the opportunity to search through his groaning bookshelves. At the back, covered in dust, I found a copy of the Bible, presented to him on graduating in medicine by his father. I looked at the Gospel of St. Mark, chapter 16, verse 6. It was the King James Version, and even if you are not a believer, the words are still very beautiful. I sat for a long time, thinking about Battle Boy and Rachel, and though I can't say that I prayed, I was thankful that at least one good thing had come out of the whole terrible enterprise. The following night, despite the pain and fatigue, I walked the unforgiving streets again. And the night after that, and the night after that. I never saw anybody, I never spoke to anyone. I was a shadow in the darkness, but a shadow growing stronger. A month later, having ventured further and further afield, I felt confident enough to put my foot to an extreme test. A 10-mile walk along a coastal path and down into a rarely visited fishing village, which the doctor said was one of the most beautiful on the coast. "Make sure you visit the boatyard," he said. "I still use the old crafts. It's the last one working in Wood. Setting off early on a cold and sharp-edged morning, I hiked through the empty hills of southern Turkey, the smell of pine and the restless sea my only companions, and, to my surprise, I did it relatively easily. I was still limping, and I had to rest from time to time, but there was no more of the vicious, debilitating pain, and I knew that my time at the doctor's was coming to an end. The coastal path eventually wound down into the village. Untouched by tourism, an authentic jumble of cottages and boat sheds, home to men and women whose lives had changed little in hundreds of years. After a lunch of fresh seafood in a sleepy cafe, I made my way to the boatyard at one end of the small cove and found that the doctor was right. It was a lovely thing to see the old kilns aglow, smoke hanging in the air and the artisans bending and shaping lengths of timber as they repaired the squat fishing boats for the next season. Nobody paid me any attention, and I wandered past the stacks of drying wood, thinking about how many great skills the world had lost, how many things of value had passed without any of us even noticing. The old men with their chisels and handsaws were once the most highly paid members of their community, and what had we put in their place? Financial engineers and young currency traders. I turned a corner and stopped. At the back of the yard, under a sagging canvas roof, perched high on wooden chocks, was a timber-hulled ketch. She was about 70 feet long, probably half a century old, and even though she was unpainted and her masts hadn't been stepped, it was clear that she would once have been a thing of beauty. Whoever owned her had used the almost lost skills of the yard to start restoring her, but by the look of the dust on her transom, they appeared to have run out either of cash or interest. I walked closer and dragged aside part of the canvas roof so that the light fell more evenly on her. I had always thought that there was nothing quite so sad as an abandoned boat, but the work that had been done on the ketch was outstanding, and it gave her a dignity that belied her distressed circumstances. Thanks to Bill's lessons on Long Island Sound, I had learned a lot about boats, and I knew just by looking at her that she was a craft that could weather almost anything.
"She's for sale," a man's voice said from behind, his English excellent for such a sleepy part of the world.
I turned and guessed it was the owner of the yard. He was in his 30s, with a ready smile, a man probably trying to make something out of the business and keep his village alive.
"A wealthy Russian found her and brought her here," he said. "In her time, she won the Fastnet, the Transpac, the Sydney to Hobart, and most of the other Blue Water classics. When we got her, she'd been rotting at the mooring in the Greek islands for years, so we started from the keel up."
"Then what happened?" I asked.
"The Russian stopped calling. More importantly, the bills weren't paid. I guess he either went broke or another oligarch had them killed."
Probably the latter, I thought. That was the way most business disputes were settled in Russia. The owner of the yard indicated an old ladder leaning against the side of the ketch.
"Please," he said,
and I climbed up and onto the broad teak deck. I saw that the cabin was set well back, slung good and low, while the wheel set high to give a commanding view of the sea. It was easy to see why the Russians had rescued her. I wandered into the wheelhouse, went below and walked quietly through her galley and bedrooms. During the years when I was sailing, I had heard men say that, once in a lifetime, a boat would talk to a sailor. And I knew, for better or worse, that the ketch was meant to be mine. The owner had followed me on board, and I emerged from a forward hatch and found him near a set of winches. "How long to paint her?" I asked.
"A week," he replied.
Getting a suit of sails would be a problem.
"We've still got the originals. They're patched, but they're okay. Come to the office and I can show you her records."
20 minutes later, I had negotiated a price and added an extra 20 grand to update the navigation equipment and have her stocked with food, fuel, and water. I borrowed the owner's cell phone, went outside and called Finbar Hanrahan in New York to arrange to have the money transferred into the owner's account. The old attorney didn't ask what it was for. On hearing that I was in Turkey, he probably assumed I was on government business and didn't press me. Before hanging up, I asked him to also send 30,000 to Dr. Sidney to compensate him for everything he had done. I had already decided I wouldn't be going back. I would sleep on the boat to supervise the work that needed to be done. I had my backpack, and inside were the sig and the letters. There was nothing else I needed. Anyway, I never liked goodbyes. I returned to the office and remembered one thing I hadn't inquired about. "What's her name?" I asked.
"Nomad," said the owner.
I nodded. If I had had any doubt that the catch was meant to be mine, the name dispelled it. I think I mentioned, in a very old use of the word, Saracen means a wanderer, a nomad. Chapter 51. I pushed out early on a Monday morning, and while the boat was really too big for one person, the skills I had learned from Bill came flooding back, and I discovered that, as long as I wasn't too ambitious, I could handle her well enough. She must have cut a strange sight, though, with her freshly painted hull, faded sails, and a patched spinnaker, but it wasn't worth worrying about. It was so late in the year, and winter was coming on so strong, that the only other craft I saw were always well off on the horizon. As I grew in confidence and my seamanship returned, I found that Nomad still had a stunning turn of speed, and after 3 weeks I was beating fast towards the boot of Italy, with the idea of heading up the Adriatic Sea towards Split in Croatia. I pulled into a tiny outpost on the western shore of Greece, no more than a general store and a decrepit jetty, to top up my fuel and buy supplies. The elderly owner fueled the boat's diesel, put the fruit and milk I had purchased into cartons, and threw in a pile of International Herald Tribunes that had gone unsold over the previous months.
"You might as well have them. I'm just going to burn them."
2 days later, sipping coffee in the late afternoon sun, making my way along a deserted coast, I was down to the last few papers when I encountered an item at the back of one of them, almost lost next to the finance pages. It was nothing much, the sort of thing you might read all the time, simply a report that Greek police had found no suspicious circumstances concerning the death of a young American woman who fell from her luxury cruiser off the coast of the party island of Mykonos. The woman, the former wife of wealthy auto heir Dodge. I sat forward and scanned the paragraphs fast until I found the name. Cameron was dead. According to the police, she fell from the back of her cruiser while intoxicated. The story said that the local medical examiner had found a cocktail of recreational drugs and alcohol in her system. In the middle of the text was a photo of Cameron and Ingrid arm in arm, posing with Ingrid's stray mutt outside an impressive Baroque building. With an increasing sense of dread, I flew through the story to find out what it meant. A few paragraphs down, I got the answer. It said Cameron had only just remarried, tying the knot with Ingrid Cole, a woman she had recently met in the town of Bodrum, Turkey. The two women were among the first to take advantage of new German legislation allowing same-sex marriages, the report said. They had flown to Berlin and were wed at the city hall 4 hours after the law came into effect, a ceremony witnessed by two strangers whom they had recruited off the street and their dog Giancarlo. The couple then began their honeymoon by returning to their boat moored near. I got to my feet and walked to the starboard rail, trying to breathe. The sun was melting into the sea, but I barely saw it. Ingrid had been right. I didn't understand the half of it. But I was certain that I did now. All my experience, all my intuition, told me that the moment they had left Berlin as a married couple, Cameron's life was effectively over. Though I couldn't prove it, I was convinced that the masterful plan Ingrid had developed in the maelstrom of 9/11 had one secret codicil which Cameron had known nothing about. Ingrid was going to make sure that she was the one who inherited Dodge's fortune. But didn't Ingrid love Cameron? I asked myself, always the investigator. But I already knew the answer. She had been betrayed and abandoned by her longtime lover. She didn't love Cameron. She hated Cameron. Of course, working to my belief, she would have had no difficulty in concealing her true feelings. She was an actress, and she would have played the part right up to the end. Once they were married, she knew that she didn't even have to get Cameron to write a will. As the legal spouse, she would inherit everything, even if Cameron died without making one.
The rest must have been easy. A long night of partying, a walk to the stern, a last kiss in the moonlight, a slender hand that tipped Cameron over the rail as the big cruiser powered on. In the dying light, I hung my head, angry with myself that I hadn't foreseen it, even though, God knows, I had been warned. I left the railing and went back to look at the date on the newspaper. It was months old. Too much time had passed. The boat would have been sold and the rest of the money transferred through a maze of untraceable offshore companies until it finally ended up in a bank like Richelieu's. Somebody as smart as Ingrid Cole, or whatever her name was, would have had a new identity and a new life waiting, and I knew that she would have disappeared already into the anonymity of the world, protected by her boundless intelligence and ingenuity. She was the best I had ever encountered, and yet, I had a strong feeling that somewhere, on some strange shore, in a street of some foreign city, in Tallinn or Riga, in Dubrovnik or Krakow, I would see a face in the crowd. Chapter 52. I sat on the deck until long after night had fallen, thinking about the two women and the events which had drawn us into each other's lives. As a covert agent, darkness had always been my friend, but since my visit to the Theater of Death, I had a fear of it which I suspected would outlast everything else in my life. I got up to switch on the running lights and check my course. Halfway along the deck, I stopped. It seemed that my course was already set. I stared at the arrangement of the stars, the position of the moon, and the pitch of the sea. When I listened, I heard a silence so loud it screamed. I had been there before. It was the vision of the future that I had seen the night I looked out of the window of the Oval Office. Just as I had glimpsed back then, I was alone on an old yacht, the sails patched and faded, the wind driving me into darkness, the boat and I growing ever smaller on a limitless sea. Now this was the night, and this was the moment, and I waited alone, barely willing to breathe, as the sea rolled towards me. Nomad heeled over, and Whitewater foamed at her bow as the wind backed a little and rapidly grew stronger. We were traveling faster, and I stepped to the railing to work the winch. The rigging started to sing under the strain, and though there was not a soul on the dark-painted ocean, I was no longer alone. Bill Murdoch was on the other winch, his wide shoulders pumping, yelling and laughing at me once again to get her damned head up into the wind. "Up forward!" a woman scrambled to set the running lights. Because my mother had died when I was so young, I remembered very little of her, and it was a source of secret pain to me that with each passing year, I could picture less and less of her face. Tonight, lit by the navigation lamps, I saw her clearly, every detail. Voices speaking in Polish came from behind me. The woman whose photo I had seen as she held her children tight and walked them towards the gas chamber was on board with me now. She was sitting in the cockpit, grown old and happy, with her adult kids and grandchildren all around her. Yes, things were dying, and it had certainly been a vision of death that I had seen, but it wasn't mine. It was another kind of death. I was bidding all the ghosts of my past goodbye. Just like the Buddhist priest had told me on the road to Koh Nyam all those years ago, if you want to be free, all you have to do is let go. And under that vaulting sky, sailing on the wine-dark sea, I realized that I was born to the secret world. I was meant to be an agent. I didn't choose it. I had never really wanted it, but that was what had been dealt to me. I had started on the journey thinking it was a burden, and that night, I saw that it was a gift. And I knew that not this year, but maybe next, I would return to New York. On a certain day, at an appointed hour, I would go to a building near Canal Street, ring the buzzer, and walk up the stairs to Old Japan. The apartment door would open, and inside, I would see a table set for three, because I knew that the man who lived there would always keep his word. As Rachel watched, Battle Boy would laugh and reach out his huge arms towards me. After a moment, we would look at each other, and he would ask me why I'd come. I would smile and say nothing. But in my heart, I would know the answer. I would know exactly what I had put behind me. It was what was written in the Gospel of St. Mark, chapter 16, verse 6. That was the part of the epic story about coming back from the dead, being restored to life. He is risen, it says. He is risen.
I Am Pilgrim, a thriller, was written by Terry Hayes and read by Christopher Ragland. The mix engineer was Terry Hogan. The associate producer was Ben Rimmelauer. This has been a presentation of Simon & Schuster Audio. I Am Pilgrim, a thriller, is available in print from Emily Bestler Books.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.